Live from the historic parsonage of 19th century gospel minister George Norcross in downtown Carlisle, Pennsylvania. It's Iron Sharpens Iron, a radio platform on which pastors, Christian scholars, and theologians address the burning issues facing the church and the world today. Proverbs 27, verse 17 tells us, iron sharpens iron, so one man sharpens another. Matthew Henry said that in this passage, quote, we are cautioned to take heed whom we converse with and directed to have in view in conversation to make one another wiser and better. It is our hope that this goal will be accomplished over the next hour, and we hope to hear from you, the listener, with your own questions. Now here's our host, Chris Arnson.
Good afternoon, Cumberland County, Pennsylvania, and the rest of humanity who are living on the planet Earth, listening via live streaming. This is Chris Arnson, and your host of Iron Sharpens Iron, wishing you all a happy Monday on this final day of February, February 29th, 2016. I'm very excited about today's interview because a lot of my listeners are excited about it. They're the ones that told me you've got to get John R. Lott Jr. on your program. John R. Lott Jr. wrote More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, and he is going to be our first guest today. In fact, one of the pastors that strongly urged me to get John on the program is a pastor in Oregon who I interviewed not long after, in fact, the day after that horrible shooting that took place in Oregon not long ago. And unfortunately, the media and the liberals and even some so-called Republicans and neoconservatives all begin to shout about the gun ownership being the problem behind these things. Well, our guest today certainly does not believe that. John R. Lott Jr. is the author of 5 books, including...
Eight.
Oh, this is an outdated bio. Including, Are Predatory Commitments Credible? Who Should the Courts Believe? And that is also published by University of Chicago Press as our book today, More Guns, Less Crime, that we're discussing, is also published by. And it's my honor and privilege to welcome you for the very first time to Iron Sharpens Iron, John R. Lott Jr.
Hi, how are you doing?
Good, and I would like to also introduce you to our co-host today, Reverend Buzz Taylor, who's been lately a frequent co-host on Iron Sharpens Iron. It's great to have you on the program today, Buzz.
Good to be back.
Let me just quickly describe the book. On its initial publication in 1998, John R. Lott's More Guns, Less Crime drew both lavish praise and heated criticism. More than a decade later, it continues to play a key role in ongoing arguments over gun control laws. Despite all the attacks by gun control advocates, no one has ever been able to refute Lott's simple, startling conclusion that more guns mean less crime. Relying on the most rigorously comprehensive data analysis ever conducted on crime statistics and right-to-carry laws, the book directly challenges common perceptions about the relationship of guns, crime, and violence. For this third edition, Lott draws on an additional 10 years of data, including provocative analysis of the effects of gun bans in Chicago and Washington, D.C., that brings the book fully up to date and further bolsters its central connection. And I'd like to just read a quick blurb from John O. McGinnis of the National Review. By providing strong empirical evidence that yet another liberal policy is a cause of the very evil it purports to cure, he, John R. Lott Jr., has permanently changed the terms of debate on gun control, a model of the meticulous application of economics and statistics to law and policy. And that was, as I said, John O. McGinnis, National Review. Well, first of all, John, how do you go about researching where you have come to the conclusion that more guns is equivalent to less crime? How do you go about doing the research on something like that?
know, there are a lot of different types of data. This, as we're reading, this, these are the largest studies that have been done on crime. So, for example, I have data for all the counties in the United States by year from 1977 through 2005. I have, in the third edition, I have data for cities, all the cities in the United States, by year over the period, and also at the state level. You try to account for many different types of gun control laws. I guess there's 13 different types of ones that we look at. Arrest rates, conviction rates, prison sentence lengths, demographics, income poverty measures, lots of different things that may affect crime rates, and to try to see what happens when, for example, more people have concealed handgun permits. What happens to crime rates? And what you find is that just as people can deter criminals with higher arrest rates or higher conviction rates by the police, the fact that would-be victims might be able to defend themselves can also deter criminals.
And how do you address the victims and the benefits from protection?
Well, when people own guns, there are a couple of things that can happen. One is you can deter criminals from attacking, but you, for those criminals who do attack, the fact that a victim has a gun turns out to be the, by far the safest course of action. There's something called the National Crime Victimization Survey, which has been around for about 40 years. And what it does is surveys about 100,000 people each year, of which about 5,000 or so are victims of violent crime. And it asks them, you know, what type of crime did a criminal try to commit? How did you respond? Was the criminal armed or not armed? Where did it take place? For the different types of responses that the victim took. And then they look at whether serious injury occurred to the victim or somebody that you were with was killed or injured. And so you can break it down very finally to see what's the safest course of action for people to take. And what you find consistently, primarily for people who are relatively weaker physically, women, the elderly, having a gun is by far the safest course of action. Women, for example, who behave passively are about 2.4 times more likely to end up being seriously injured than a woman who has a gun.
Yeah, it is ironic that liberals who tend to be feminists are so much in favor in the vast numbers of gun, very strict gun control laws. I mean, some obviously would wish to ban all private gun ownership, and yet women are probably going to be among the greatest victims of gun crime, at least those that are...
of crime. Look, I mean, there are two groups of people who benefit the most. The people who are most likely to be victims of crime, and that overwhelmingly tends to be poor blacks who live in high-crime urban areas, and people who are relatively weaker physically, women and the elderly. And so I would argue it's basically the most vulnerable people in our society who benefit the most from having the option to be able to go and protect themselves.
Yes, and now, obviously, whenever one of these horrific crimes is headlining in the news about a school or a convenience store or fast food restaurant or a post office or whatever the situation is, where you have numerous people shot by crazed gunmen, they always talk about how private gun ownership and soft gun control laws are what gives rise to these things. Now, are these acts, these horrific crimes that we all hear about, to your knowledge, committed by people who are owning legal guns and who are, purchased guns through normal circumstances and legal means?
Well, that depends, but not always. But the one common feature that you see in these mass public shootings is that they keep on occurring time after time in places where people aren't allowed to have guns for protection. If you look at news since 1950, with just three exceptions, every single one of the mass public shootings in the United States have taken place where where general citizens are allowed to have guns for protection. And what's clear is how these killers, time after time, take that into consideration. These killers, these mass public shooters in the United States, they're trying to commit suicide, but they want to do so in a way that's going to get them attention. They know that the more people that they can kill or injure, the more attention that they're going to be able to get. So, for example, you know, just one example, you look at the Newtown killer. He had collected data on mass public shootings over a few decade period of time, had collected the number of people killed or injured in each attack, and gone back and found the amount of news coverage on each of those attacks. And then he had graphed it out, showing that the attacks that had gotten the most people killed had gotten the most news attention. And according to police, he wanted to go and kill more people than were killed in the Norway attack, which up until the Paris attack held the record for the most people killed or injured in a mass public shooting in Europe or the United States. And, you know, because he wanted to get more worldwide attention than even the Norway killer had received. It's chilling to go through and read the diaries or listen to other documents that these individuals leave about how explicit they are about trying to go to some place where nobody's going to be able to stop them for a while, because they know that the more that if they go to a place where victims are defenseless, they're going to be able to go and kill more people. And they know, and how chilling it is to hear them say that if they can go to a place where people can't defend themselves and they can kill more people, they'll get more media attention, because that's their goal. They want to commit suicide, but they want to do so in a way that will get them attention.
Well, I'm going to give our email address if anybody would like to join us on the air with a question of your own. Our email address is chrisarnson@gmail.com. chrisarnson@gmail.com. Please give us your first name, your city and state of residence, and your country of residence if you live outside of the USA. Now, does your data that you are addressing in your book, is that only data that reflects upon the United States, or do you go into Europe and so on with these statistics?
It's primarily data from the United States, but we look at data from around the world. I mean, I'll give you one example, and that is every single time a gun's been banned any place in the world, not just in Washington, D.C., and Chicago, you see murder rates go up after the ban. You know, in Washington, D.C., and Chicago, the claim is, well, unless you ban guns over the entire country, criminals will still get guns from Maryland or Virginia or from the rest of Illinois. The problem is that may explain why crime rates didn't fall as much as gun control advocates were predicting when these laws were passed, but it surely doesn't explain why they increased so much after the bans went into place, because presumably people could go and get those guns from those other places to begin with. But the thing is, when you look around the world, even in entire nations, even in island nations, which you think would be the ideal experiment, there's no neighbor for them to go and blame, readily defined, easily defensible borders. And yet what you see in each of those cases where guns are banned, you see large increases in murder rates that occur right after the bans go into effect. And, you'd think at least one time, out of randomness, you'd see murder rates go down. But that hasn't been the case. They go up every single time. And, I think there's a simple explanation for that, and that is when you ban guns, it's the most law-abiding good citizens who obey the laws, and when you disarm the law-abiding good citizens, we're all criminals. You actually make it relatively easier for the criminals to go and commit crimes.
And we do have a listener in Great Neck, Long Island, New York, Robert, who asks, is it true that you, John, used to be an imbecile, I mean liberal, when it comes to gun control laws?
I'd say I was pretty much in the middle of the debate on this stuff. I surely didn't believe what I believe now. was probably as affected by everybody else as anybody else by the media coverage. I mean, when you constantly hear about bad things that happen with guns and never hear about the benefits, it has a real impact on people's perceptions about the costs and benefits of guns. And even though I had been chief economist at the U.S. Sentencing Commission and did a lot of research on crime generally, I'd never really been interested in the issue of guns. I just kind of backed into it. And, you know, I was surprised to see the large net benefits that people have. Look, there's one thing anybody who reads my research knows, and I find police are extremely important in stopping crime. I think police are the single most important factor in stopping crime. Well, one thing is clear is that the police themselves understand the limits to what they can do. They realize that even though they are important, they virtually always arrive on a crime scene after the crime's occurred.
Yeah.
And that raises the question, what should people do when they're having to confront a criminal by themselves? Police realize for their own lives how important guns are to them. And I think it's hard to find any other group in the population that's as supportive of private gun ownership as police officers are. You know, when you talk about mass public shootings, if you look at Police One, which is the largest private organization of police officers in the country with about 450,000 members, you know, you can find their surveys on our website at crimeresearch.org. You find that 80% of the police think that getting rid of these so-called gun-free zones, allowing people to be able to have their permanent concealed handguns with, will make a big difference in terms of stopping these types of attacks.
We do have another listener in Newville, Pennsylvania, Susan, who asks, do you believe that an American citizen should be able to purchase any type of weapon, and how would that affect the local police protection that you mentioned, where the citizens of a given community may be more powerfully armed than the local police?
Well, I don't think the citizens are more powerfully armed. You know,
I think that the
discussions about things like assault weapons, for example, and people seem to think that there's something different than they actually are. If you look at an assault weapon, at least the way it's defined in the media and what have you, is basically a semi-automatic rifle that functions identically to a semi-automatic hunting rifle. Fires the same bullets with the same rapidity doing the same damage. In fact, you know, guns like the AR-15 or Bushmaster, those are similar to small caliber hunting rifles. You know, they're basically too small of a caliber to even be legally able to use to hunt deer in many states because they're more likely to wound rather than kill the deer. But, you know, if you want to go and ban all semi-automatic weapons, you know, at least let's talk about that, but at least, but to try to go and ban some semi-automatic rifles based on how they look rather than how they function, you know, just doesn't make a lot of sense to me. So, I mean, if she wants to be specific about the types of guns or whatever that she thinks should be banned, I'm happy to talk to.
Well, let me just ask you a question. If you could give me a list as brief as you want to give, or as lengthy as you want to give, what weapons do you believe should be banned, if any?
Well, I have absolutely no problem with people owning any type of semi-automatic weapon. People do in the United States own automatic weapons, but it's very heavily licensed, and there's no crimes that are committed with those guns. The crimes are committed with the semi-automatic weapons. But if, you know, if somebody wants to, you know, if she wants to point to some other types of gun, semi-automatic, whatever, that she thinks could be banned, I'm happy to talk about.
So are you saying then that you do believe that there is a limit, in your opinion, as to what guns an American citizen should be legally able to own?
Well, there probably really is. All I can tell you is I do empirical work. I look at what guns people can own.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't have data on what they might possibly be able to own. And at least in the range of guns that people can legally own, which are, we can see rules changing, semi-automatic weapons, I don't see any evidence that any changes in the types of semi-automatic weapons that people are able to own has any bad impact on crime rates.
Yeah. Well, I was actually asking about your personal opinion on that, what you thought, but...
I don't have personal opinions on this type of stuff. I just try to look to see what the data shows on them.
I see. Mm. And now, what is the most typical weapon that is used in committing deadly crime in the United States?
Basically, a handgun, semi-automatic handgun, a pistol.
Mm-hmm. And what areas in the United States are the freest and loosest when it comes to gun control laws?
Well, I suppose you have a lot of the western states, a lot of the south. It's basically, as far as gun control goes, the strict gun control states are basically California, New York, mm-hmm. New Jersey, Maryland, those states around there, D.C., obviously. That's where you see, by far the strictest gun control. Most of the rest of the country is relatively liberal. I mean, there's variations that you see on it. But, for example, there's 10 states now that you can carry concealed handguns without a permit. It's basically Alaska, Arizona, Wyoming, Arkansas, Mississippi, Maine, Vermont, and then there are two states where you carry in virtually all the state without a permit. And that's Idaho and Montana, like 99.4% of the state in those two states you can carry without a permit. So, I mean, that's just one example. There you have states from the west to the south to the north.
And why is it that this seems to be, I mean, it seems to be, as even the book cover has described it, as a very simple and almost like a no-brainer conclusion that you've drawn. Yeah, if more people have guns in a certain area, people are going to be more afraid to commit a crime in that area because they don't want to get killed themselves. But why is this such, it seems such a secret or something that is not even addressed when Republicans and so-called conservatives are standing behind podiums talking about gun rights?
I don't know. I mean, you have lots of people, Ted Cruz, Marco Rubio, some others like that, Carlosina Arena, others, Ben Carson, I think, have done a good job of explaining the reasoning that's involved here. I mean, when I go and debate, sometimes one of the simple questions I ask is, if, God forbid, somebody was stalking you or threatening you or your family, would you feel safer putting a sign in front of your house that says your home is gun-free zone? And I never run into anybody that I'm debating that would say that. I think in part they won't say that, because they know it's not going to be credible with the audience. They realize that if they say that, sure, I'll put a sign like that, they'd lose credibility. So even the strictest gun control proponents would argue that, and there's a simple reason for that. And that is, if you were to actually put a sign like that in front of your home, they realize it would be a magnet for criminals. If they would view that, it's not like they said, oh, I'm not allowed to bring my gun in, so I won't attack. Instead, they'll think to themselves, this is an easy target. This is what I'm going to go after. And that's what you see time after time, whether it be, just last month, there was almost an attack at one of the largest churches in Detroit.
Right.
ISIS sympathizer,
his father, fortunately, had realized that there was something wrong with his son, and he contacted the FBI, and the FBI put a watcher on him, and found that he was plotting to attack one of the largest churches. One of the reasons that he gave was that he said there are a lot of people there, you'll get a lot of coverage, and nobody else there is allowed to have a gun, so it'll be very easy to go and attack people and kill them without them being able to stop them from doing the attack. But you see this time after time. You look at last year, the Charleston shooting, or when the diary came out last year from the Batman movie theater. Similar types of things came out. The first target for the Charleston shooter was supposed to be Charleston College. It was one of the people looked into it and realized that the security that they had there, he decided to go after the church where he knew that there'd be nobody there to go and stop him. In the Batman movie theater, in the diary that he put out, his first target was going to be an airport, but he found that there'd be too much security there and they would kill him before he was able to go and kill his victims. When, even when he was picking movie theaters, there were 7 movie theaters that were within a 20-minute drive of his apartment. Only one of those movie theaters posted signs banning permanent concealed handguns. He didn't go to the movie theater closest to his home. He didn't go to the one that advertised itself prominently as having the largest auditoriums in the state of Colorado. Instead, he went to the only one where he knew victims weren't able to defend themselves. And I can go through cases from the previous year, like the Santa Barbara shoot, or in Canada, the New Brunswick attack, where, again, these killers understood that they wanted to try to go and find venues where people wouldn't be able to stop them from doing their attack.
And by the way, I want to let our listeners that wrote in with questions, Robert in Great Neck, New York, Susan in Newville, Pennsylvania, you're getting free copies of this book, More Guns, Less Crime, Understanding Crime and Gun Control Laws, compliments of University of Chicago Press. We do have an anonymous listener in Alabama who says that he asked a pastor he knows if he packed a gun, and the pastor said absolutely. And when he said to ask the pastor if someone began shooting from the outside of your congregation, an intruder came in and began shooting in your church, what would you do? And the pastor said, "I'd duck." And the anonymous listener said, "Why would you do that?" And he said, "Because I don't want to be hit by the crossfire of everybody else in the church shooting the criminal."
Yeah.
But I'd like you to...
Well, you know what? Just one last comment on that. That is, if you go to our website at crimeresearch.org, you'll find we have dozens of cases of mass public shootings that have been stopped by citizens with permanent concealed handguns. Mm-hmm. And one of the concerns that's often voiced is, well, won't you accidentally shoot a bystander? The thing is, if I look through these cases, and there's not one single case where a bystander has been accidentally shot by a permit holder. The other concern that's raised is, well, when the police arrive on the scene, won't they go and accidentally shoot the permit holder? And that's never occurred either. So while those types of concerns are possible, I would just say it's not something that we actually observe happening.
And I know that you also have a blog site that is John R.
CrimeResearch.org for the Crime Prevention Research Center that can go and find a lot of stuff.